rival factions in Sudan clash for the second day as the civilian death toll from the violence reaches 56. Israel plans to implement some 10 major settlement projects in the occupied outlets and the West Bank as part of its much-criticized land-grab policy. And French police are caught on camera using disproportionate force against protesters in the northwestern city of Rennes. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Rival factions in Sudan clash for the second day as the death toll from the violence reaches 56. Witnesses say heavy fighting is underway in the capital, Khartoum, as well as the cities of Omdurman, Port Sudan, and Bahari. The army has also launched airstrikes on a base belonging to the paramilitary Rapid Support Force known as RSF near the capital, Khartoum. The RSF claimed to have seized the presidential palace, army chief's residence, state television station, and airports in Khartoum. The army has rejected those assertions. The Sudanese Doctors Union says at least 56 civilians and scores of military personnel have been killed and nearly 600 injured so far. The fighting follows weeks of tensions between military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the RSF over the planned integration of the group into the regular army. We were earlier joined by political commentator Sami Hamdi and asked him about the root cause of the ongoing fighting in Sudan. Here's what he told us.
I think first and foremost, it's important to remember the context within which this is taking place, which is that you have a transition taking place in Sudan in which the parties are trying to come to some sort of agreement regarding power sharing and also trying to pressure Burhan, the head of the military council, to hand over power to civilian parties. Burhan has dragged his heels primarily because he's aware that the handover of power is essentially to civilian parties that he believes and the civilian parties themselves believe would not be able to win any seats or would not be able to win a majority in any election. The civilian parties, as part of pressuring Burhan to hand over power to him, sought to rally around Hemeti, the head of the Rapid Support Forces. They sought to rally around him and essentially try to coax him into toppling Burhan for them and then agreeing to a power-sharing transition agreement in which they would able to seize 66% of the parliament and which in which they were able to embark on ideological changes to the state before going to an elections at a time in which they believe they could win. Burhan knew that they were rallying around Hemeti, so Burhan arranged his own process through which he managed to get more civilian parties to join the process to dilute the power of the other civilian parties, but also imposed a condition whereby the Rapid Support Forces would have to give up much of its influence in exchange for a transition in which Burhan shares power. So Hemeti, believing that Burhan is going to take away some of his power, has decided that now is the time to act. He's moved his forces to try to topple Burhan in order essentially to oust Burhan from the game entirely and to impose himself before Burhan has a chance to rein him in and essentially clip his wings.
Political analyst Jonathan Ofe-Onsa says struggles between the army and the RSF have casted a shadow on the transition of power to civilian governments.
Tensions between the regular army and the RSF go back a long way, you know, since the days of the deposed president al-Bashir, you know. But tensions, you know, have since remained. General Dankadi, who heads the RSF, is the deputy head of the sovereign military council that is ruling the country at present. So the tension actually is between the army and the paramilitary, which stems from how the two sides should merge. Mm-hmm. The regular army, the army itself, I think, is prepared to hand over power. But from what is happening now, it appears the RSF is rather reluctant to do so. Because right now, it appears all the signs point to a military coup because they've taken the airport, they've taken most of the military bases in the capital and so on and so forth. So it appears there is a military coup, and should it succeed, it will, you know, set back, you know, the planned transition to civilian rule.
Israel plans to implement some 10 major settlement projects in the occupied outlets in the West Bank. The projects include the construction of hundreds of new settler units and the expansion of some of the already constructed settlements. As part of the plans, the regime also intends to build roads as well as a major tunnel under the Kalandia checkpoint north of Al-Quds to connect settlements in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv gave the go-ahead for the projects back in 2017. Experts see such projects as part of Israel's land grab policy. People have rallied for the 15th consecutive week in Tel Aviv to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The protesters held signs and chanted slogans against the far-right Israeli cabinet. They urged Netanyahu to scrap the legislation despite his decision to delay the process. In recent weeks, protesters have clashed with regime forces across the occupied territories. The demonstrations erupted in January after the cabinet announced its reforms to limit the Supreme Court's powers. Critics argue that the changes will foster corruption and bring about diplomatic isolation. Israeli forces have attacked Christians celebrating the Orthodox Holy Light Ceremony in the old city of Al-Quds. The attacks occurred when thousands of Orthodox Christians filled the old city under a heavy presence of regime forces. Israel has significantly limited access to the events, citing safety concerns. Church leaders, however, have urged Christians to ignore the restrictions, calling the measure part of long-standing efforts by the regime to push out the local Christian community. Some church leaders have also voiced concern over what they describe as an environment of impunity in the face of rising acts of violence and vandalism targeting Christians and their properties in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement, the Islamic Jihad, has condemned Israel's attack, describing it as racist and a violation of the rights of Christian citizens. Earlier, our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, told us that the so-called Israeli safety measures are only meant to bar the Palestinian Christians from entering the old city of Al-Quds.
Let's say the Orthodox Palestinian Christians are celebrating today one of their major holidays, the Orthodox Holy Light Ceremony, where Christians go to Al-Quds and visit the secular church there. From the early hours of Saturday, Palestinian Christians are prohibited. Only Christians from around the world are allowed. The church, we consider this move as another attempt by the Israelis to attack the Palestinians and to continue to practice more aggressive measures against Palestinians. And they said it's an opportunity to tell the whole world that Palestinians, whether they are Christians or Muslims, are under Israeli attack, because at the end of the day, Israel wants to impose more facts on ground and more facts on ground to tell the world that Al-Quds would be occupied by the Israelis, by the Jewish Israelis, and that Palestinians, regardless of their religion, they are not welcome there, or they have to live under the Israeli measures and under the Israeli rules.
People across the world have marked International Quds Day. There have been a massive turnout, with people coming out to show solidarity with Palestinians. Meanwhile, Iran has said Palestine and the holy city of Al-Quds have turned into symbols of unity in the Muslim world. International Quds Day Rallies 2023. Massive crowds filled the streets of all major cities in the Islamic Republic. The show of support for Palestinians was astounding. But these rallies were not limited to just Iran. This year, more people came out in support of Al-Quds Day, an occasion designated by the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, over 40 years ago. One day prior to the event, Iran and several Arab countries like Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq held naval parades, something not done in the past.
Then came the show of support by resistance groups and religious leaders.
It is enough for the Arabs and the Muslims in the world and all the peoples of the world. And also, Al-Quds has its significance for Palestine. And this is part and parcel of the religious duties. In this state, we need to shoulder the efforts to support the West Bank and Al-Quds.
But why was this but state different? For starters, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was a scene of multiple violations and desecrations by Israeli forces and settlers. The beating of Palestinian worshippers brought world condemnation against Israel and its officials. In the spotlight, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and extreme far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. When it came to the issue of Al-Quds, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to announce that the Al-Aqsa Mosque would be limited only to Palestinian worshippers until the end of the holy month of Ramadan. His minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, slammed the move. Many saw that as a sign of a further rift with Netanyahu.
The International Quds Day has one common theme worldwide, that is solidarity with Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli occupation.
Never before, Israel is finding itself to be isolated and weak. On the one hand, Israel is unraveling from within. Strikes and protests against the so-called judicial reforms have extended to over 3 months now. Meanwhile, Israelis are leaving Israel en masse. On the other hand, the economy is being battered. Massive capital flights, investor confidence at an all-time low. After all, who wants to invest in an economy where there are massive protests in which the fate of the ruling coalition is not known? His partnership with what some have called fascists and extremists has deteriorated Israel's standing, even with its staunchest allies, especially the U.S. A group of U.S. senators have urged the U.S. president not to use taxpayers' money in Israeli settlements and to stop violating Palestinian rights. According to a recent poll by Gallup, for the first time, more Democrats sympathize with Palestinians than they do with Israelis. 49% of Democrats answered that they sympathize more with Palestinians, an 11-point increase over the past year. Meanwhile, Israel is facing an unprecedented national security threat from resistance groups. Recently, a barrage of rockets from resistance groups from southern Lebanon was met with a counterfire from Israel, which only targeted open areas, in fear of not getting involved in a war, especially with Hezbollah. And a further threat to Israel, the geopolitical shift in West Asia from Iran's reconciliation with Saudi Arabia has thrown Israel's security to a state of red alert. Israeli hopes of normalization with Saudi Arabia appear to be dashed, at least for now. Counting on an Arab-Israeli alliance in the face of Iran and the axis of resistance is over, said the Hezbollah chief, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. As a result of Iran-Saudi normalization, the axis of resistance has been recalibrated, especially with Syria coming back into the fold. 21 years ago, George Bush uttered these words in his State of the Union address.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Ironic that now those words hold true for the U.S. and Israel, especially when it comes to their presence in the West Asia region.
South Africa is making moves to send a stronger message to isolate Israel. Marking Quds Day, they believe the global political reality also brings liberation of Al-Quds closer. Hassan Seria reports.
Under the watchful gaze of South Africa's own anti-apartheid icons, they came out to highlight the plight of the Palestinian people again. For decades, many of those here have marched annually to the gates of Parliament, demanding decisive action from the government, which itself fought a racist supremacist regime once.
We need to break diplomatic ties with Israel as well as economic ties with them. They should become a pariah state. We shouldn't have any sort of diplomatic visits to Israel as well as from Israel. And they should be made to feel demonized on a global scale.
In a groundbreaking move just weeks ago, Parliament passed a motion to downgrade ties with the Israeli regime. But questions remain whether the ANC-led government will see this through. After years of advocating neutrality, South Africa took a more resolute stance against Israel at the African Union, preventing the Zionist regime from gaining observer status. Representatives from the ruling party participated in the International Quds Day march to Parliament here and agreed more needs to be done.
We need legal action, both from United Nations. There's a duplicity of especially Western countries around this matter. It's very clear that Israel is being isolated on this. The Middle East is coming too. There's a strong, overwhelming critical mass of all countries and freedom-loving people saying that enough is enough and this atrocities must stop. So we as South Africa, we call on this. We believe this. We will be continuing to fight for the cause of the Palestinian people.
South Africa withdrew its ambassador from Israel in 2018, but the Israeli ambassador still enjoyed full diplomatic status here. The parliamentary motion pledges to expel Tel Aviv's representative and downgrade the embassy to a liaison office. Underpinned by the vision of International Quds Day for those who have protested here annually, the latest moves are a victory indeed. Hassan Siria, Cape Town.
French police have been caught on camera using disproportionate force against protesters in the northwestern city of Rennes. Footage from the incident shows riot police handcuffing a man and a woman while restraining them. Eyewitnesses said the man was wrestled to the ground after he tried to help the woman, who was being dragged on the ground. It took place during a demonstration where police fired tear gas to disperse protesters. France has seen months of violent protests over the government's controversial plan to raise the retirement age to 64. President Emmanuel Macron signed the bill into law on Saturday. This has angered unions, which have called for the demonstrations to continue. New data indicates food prices in a number of European countries are drastically increasing amid an unprecedented cost of living crisis there. The French National Statistics Office says the price of cooking coco-ve, a French main dish, rose to nearly 20 euros. That's more than 15% rise from a year earlier. The price of chicken also jumped by about 18%, while the price of carrots rose by more than 33% compared to the same month a year ago. In Spain, the price of olive oil surged more than 32%. Rice prices also saw a significant rise from a year ago. The prices are expected to stay high as drought-like conditions and historically low-level rains threaten crops. Europe is already grappling with the cost of living crisis, with 93% of Europeans impacted by record high inflation throughout the continent. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, April 16th, 2023. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received reception reports from around the world. From Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, from Ratan Kumar Paul from India, and Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands. So, Mizanur Rahman, Rob, and Ratan, thank you very much for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. And you know why? Because these reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. So, all of you who have sent in reception report will be receiving electronic QSL card from us. Thank you for your support and commitment, dear listeners. And we've received piles of letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of your names here, and later during the program, I will read your emails. From Bangladesh, we've received an email from Bhathon Rudra. Hector Friahofre from Chile, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands, our regular listeners, has sent us an email. Kurt Ettlinger from Germany has sent us a message. And the last but not the least is an email from India, from Mukesh Kumar. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. So let's see what Bhathon Rudra from Bangladesh says. Hi, my radio friends. How are you? I love and will love radio because it is my friend and it is the best media all over the world. And I appreciate all the efforts of radio workers and radio listeners. God bless you all. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from IRIB English Radio. Bhathon Rudra from Bangladesh, many thanks for your support and commitment and, of course, your encouraging words. We also appreciate you for your views about IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Please accept our electronic QSL, our eQSL as confirmation. And one of our old and regular listeners from Chile, Hector Fria Jofre, has sent us an email. Hector says, "Hello, I hope that the IRIB transmissions reach all parts of the world. Also, I hope my QSL and the requested information will soon reach my hands. I believe that Iran will successfully overcome the restrictions and sanctions caused by the US, and you have the support of many people like me from other countries. Best regards." Salam, Hector, and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Appreciations to you for this email, Hector. We are proud that the signals of IRIB English Radio are received everywhere in the world, including in Chile. Also, many thanks for your comments about the success of Iran in overcoming the U.S. unilateral sanctions, as well as your support for an independent country like Iran. Hector Ferrejofra from Chile, write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. And please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation. After a short break, I will be back with you. This is Listeners Special, and our Indian listener, Mukesh Kumar, has sent us a message. Mukesh says, "Dear sir or madam, greetings. Me and my club members are English radio enthusiasts. On the behalf of all the club members, I would like to send our love to you via this email. God bless you." Salam and greetings to you and your club members, and thank you very much for this email. Please accept our eQSL as verification. God bless you too. Mukesh Kumar from India, thank you again. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. And from Netherlands, we've received an email from one of our old and regular listeners, from Rob den Boer. Rob says, "Dear Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's radio, I'm glad to confirm your broadcast today at 6040 kilohertz here in the Netherlands. I heard at 1945 UTC, a female telling a historical Islamic story in English language, which I found it quite interesting. Please verify my report by your eQSL. Thank you so much." Salam and greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Rob den Boer from the Netherlands. Many thanks for this email and thank you very much for letting us know what you think about our broadcast. I wish you could tell us the name of the program you heard. Anyway, we will confirm your report by an eQSL, Rob. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Okay, after a short break, I will be back with you. Okay, let's see what Kurt Ettlinger from Germany says. Kurt says, dear staff at the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a DXing fan, I found your programs very interesting and full of information. I hope I would be able to find more frequencies of your station. So I would be very grateful to you if you can send me QSL card for my reception report. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran. It's an honor to have you with us as a listener, Kurt Ettlinger from Germany. So please refer to our website at parstoday.ir/en. That is parstoday.ir/en to find the frequency schedule as well as the archives of our programs. Kurt Ettlinger from Germany, thank you very much for this email. Please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. We had a good time together, but we have to say goodbye. But before that, I send my warm appreciations and gratitudes to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Ratan Kumar Paul from India, Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Robden Boer from the Netherlands, Badhon Rudra from Bangladesh, Hector Fria Hofre from Chile, Mukesh Kumar from India, and also Kurt Ettlinger from Germany. Please keep in touch with us. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Kicking off his first state visit to China since taking office in January, the Brazilian President Lula da Silva did not hold back his feelings. He called on developing countries to work towards replacing the U.S. dollar with their own currencies in international trade. He also called for BRICS countries to come up with their own alternative currency for use in trade. Is this a further blow to the U.S. and the dollar dominance? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the significance of Latin America's number one economy, teaming up with the world's soon-to-be number one economy in the world, namely China, and what impact that would have on the world economy, in particular, the U.S. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Gilbert Doctor, our independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Matthew Everett, who's a senior fellow at American University in Moscow, joining us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctor, I'll first over to you. This visit obviously is quite a stark contrast in terms of the sentiment that is behind Lula da Silva compared to the former President Bolsonaro, who was keen to keep a relative distance towards China, especially when it comes to the foreign policy arena, which we'll get to later. How big a deal is this for Latin America's number one economy to team up with China, soon to be the number one economy in the world?
Oh, it's a very big deal. And the particular emphasis placed on de-dollarization is in line with many other similar developments across the world in the last few weeks. This is a kind of tidal wave of the formerly called the Third World or the countries that were non-aligned. They have, or now it's the popular word for this is the Global South, has been expressing itself in favor of a more democratic economic power, distribution of economic power across the world, for which reserve currencies are an important part of the structure. And what we have here is still, until now, a relatively small change in the percentage of trading across the globe that is done in non-dollar currencies. But in the case of the yuan, the renminbi, it has gone up, almost doubled in the last few months. Nonetheless, we're speaking about 4 or 5% of the global trade, and the United States still having something like 70 or 80% of global trade. So it's a long way to go. However, de-dollarization has several dimensions, and I hope we can get into that later in this discussion.
I hope so too. Matthew Everett, some of the questions asked by Lula. Every night I ask myself, why do all countries have to base their trade on the dollar? Why can't we do trade based on our own currencies? Who was it that decided that the dollar was the currency after the disappearance of the gold standard? Why is Lula asking these questions now? And what do you think? Is he asking the right questions?
I think that he is definitely asking the right questions, which have been on everyone's mind. And it has been sort of the elephant in the room that no one was allowed to speak about for the past 50, 60 years, especially. Which is that, I mean, why is it ultimately that we, I use the term we in the broad sense, but why should nations of the world who are doing bilateral agreements with each other utilize the dollars, the U.S. dollars, which have no interest in those trade agreements going forward and are tied in many cases to speculative interests, were able to use the floating exchange rate system upon which the dollar was pegged after it was floated from the gold reserve standard back in 1971. As a tool for speculation. This creates a lot of instability. It opens up the door to vulture funds, people like George Soros, who made a killing literally for decades off of speculating on commodities, on other forms, but especially currencies, in order to intentionally destabilize target governments that are maybe looking out a little bit too much for the sovereign interests of their people. So the fact that right now you have a very clear case of the U.S. dollar as an overbloated speculative debt-based weapon, which is in the middle of collapsing, has given people, I think, a lot of courage that they would not have normally had a decade ago to say what
Lula
and
collapsing?
Xi Jinping and others are saying. Yeah.
Why would you say it's in the middle of collapsing?
Well, the U.S. has already moved its debt ceiling up. I think it's $31 trillion at this point. There's a veritable crisis right now. We don't know if the U.S. dollar is going to default or not. We know also that money printing didn't end in 2009. There's been an ongoing quantitative easing policy that has been in the trillions and trillions, justifying a Wall Street City of London-directed bubble of derivatives that are something like 20 times larger than the global measurable GDP accumulatively, which itself, derivatives didn't even really exist in a meaningful way 30 years ago. This was created as a metastasizing cancer in an age of unbounded speculation and deregulation. So this is a perfect storm of chaos that's going to be ripping apart the transatlantic economy if nothing systemic is done.
Well, Gilbert Doctor, can you please expand more to us what you said, which I thought perhaps was one of the highlights of your previous statements there, when you said a more democratic form of power needs to be more used in reference to, of course, money and trade in general. What is so non-democratic about the dollar, and will this more democratic form of power actually come into being based on, I don't know, maybe the yuan coming into strength? You tell us what you think.
Well, there are several dimensions, as I said, to this question. One is goods are denominated in, and what currency is used to denominate the value of goods that are in commercial exchange across the world. That is one dimension. Another dimension is what currencies are used on the commodity exchanges, which commodities exchanges are dominating given commodities. As regards commodities, there are many commodities that have a heavy weight in global trade. The most significant one, of course, is hydrocarbons, and that means particularly oil. When we go back to 1971 and what changed in the world after that, how the United States and the dollar came to be so dominant, there's a word that comes to mind, and that is the petrodollar. The hydrocarbons were, from that time on, denominated in dollars, and that became the fundamental backbone of dollar strength, for which other commodities and other goods exchanges were denominated. One other aspect of this, which nobody talks about, is the information flow. Since almost all of the trading based in dollars is passing through American banks, the United States government has had an information flow that is quite unbelievable. There's a big complaint about Huawei and how the Chinese could possibly have access to the personal information of the users of Huawei telecommunication systems. The same issue comes up with TikTok. However, this is nothing compared to the information flow about who is selling what to whom that the United States possesses through the very fact of all transactions going through American banks. That is another dimension that people don't talk about much. The sensitivity of these issues to the United States has been quite unbelievable. If we go back, we saw this past week on his interview given on the plane from which he returned from his China visit to France. Emmanuel Macron said that we should de-dollarize. We shouldn't be so dependent on the dollar. Now, let's go back a bit in history. In 2010, when he was still the president of the world of the IMF, Strauss-Kahn was suspected by his American friends, colleagues, and those who are listening to him for intelligence purposes. He was suspected of being anti-dollar. He was promoting the special drawing rights as an alternative to the dollar in settling world trade. On that very basis, he was framed in the United States. He was entrapped in a hotel scandal, which brought him before the justice wearing handcuffs and nearly sent him off to a prison sentence. He was removed from the French presidential race, where he was a leading candidate being proposed by the socialists.
Sure.
This type of American intervention in French politics has continued up through the race that brought Macron to his president position 6 years ago. Well, this was so sensitive to the United States that a dollar could be exposed in the way that Strauss-Kahn was thinking of doing, that they brought down the French government. And here we have Macron speaking liberally about it because everybody is speaking liberally about de-dollarization.
They are. They are. That's true. So let's go to one of the statements they're made, Matthew, from Gilbert Doctorow about the banking structure. The reason why I want to have you elaborate on this a little bit more is because the Brazilian president has actually called on the developing countries to go for replacing the dollar with their own currencies. Now, BRICS to have a currency to finance trade relations between those countries requires a financial system that has a structure, something that's other, that's different than what's being used currently. Is that feasible? And is that something that is going to happen? Of course, we have to wait. All eyes are going to be on South Africa when the BRICS meet. But I think it's going to be somewhat feasible because, well, what do you know? The former Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, is the head of the new development bank. Is that a coincidence?
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it's not only feasible, it's absolutely necessary if humanity is going to have a future. I mean, it simply is the case that it has to come online if we're going to be able to make it through the current storms that are threatening to tear apart civilization in a variety of ways. So the fact is that Lula has been somebody who, from a very early stage, many years ago, was a big part of bringing online the new development bank, the BRICS Bank, back in 2014. It had a very strong manifesto and mandate at the Fortaleza conference in Brazil in order to provide long-term low-interest credit for the purpose of large-scale development, ending hunger, ending poverty, creating stability. That was very clearly the need and the purpose. And unfortunately, over the past 7 or 8 years, it hasn't been permitted to express its own mandate, largely because, well, the choice, for whatever reason, was made to still adopt overall Western IMF-directed standards of banking and financial behavior. And so it hasn't really permitted itself to be the type of offensive instrument for real development. Ironically, the way the IMF and World Bank back in 1944 were originally designed, I believe, by Franklin Roosevelt and Henry Wallace and his allies to provide that type of anti-colonial long-term development to internationalize the successful economic model of the New Deal that had worked so well in America that was being offered to India, Africa, China, South America. Brazil was supposed to be a big recipient. As part of the Four Freedoms vision of Franklin Roosevelt to create a world without hunger, without poverty, and for mutual win-win development. That wasn't permitted when Roosevelt died a bit too early. His enemies amongst the deep state took control. We know that story. But I think today we're at a point where the time has yet come once again for this type of renewal of real human-directed banking that prioritizes necessity and humanity and the general good over private, you know, interests, which shouldn't be crushed, but at the same time should be put in their proper sphere of priorities, which sure. is what you see from the Eurasian orientation of finance.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sure. Well, to maybe distance a little bit from the economics of this all, Gilbert Doctorow, we're looking at, obviously, the Chinese leader welcoming Lula the way that he has, especially with the business delegation. But I'm guessing that Xi Jinping is going to be keen to have asked the Brazilian president if he's so interested in this trade relationship with China, in for the large part, that he's going to want some kind of backing for China's foreign policy initiatives. I'm guessing that that's something that they've discussed and that China's probably somewhat insistent on that. What arenas do you think the Chinese president would focus on in his talks with Lula when it comes to backing China on these foreign policy initiatives?
Well, the focus, of course, is on BRICS. BRICS is one of the two vehicles or platforms that China is using to reorganize the management of world affairs. It is one of two boards of directors where China has a key seat. The other, of course, is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is primarily about security. I don't believe that President Xi is going to be discussing with Lula very much about security. It is primarily economics that they will discuss because the importance, the prominence of Brazil is as a founder of BRICS. So the foreign policy statements that they make will have to be carefully coordinated because Brazil has been less accommodative towards Russia on the Ukraine war than China has been. And that has to be remarked, where Brazil stood in the United Nations General Assembly vote that was proposed by the United States to censure Russia. It was not on the side of the angels. That is certainly going to be a topic, but whether or not she will succeed in moving Lula on that, I don't know.
Well, the headline that I'd like you to comment on, Matthew, read that... let me read it. Xi and Lula to steer new future for China-Brazil ties from strategic perspective, in which it would involve schemes to create an alternative international governance system in reference to the new world order, to those dominated by the U.S. So that's cutting it right to the chase. It's right there in black and white, this particular headline, and, of course, the subtitle to it. Do you think that that's really something that's going on?
That is absolutely what is going on. And the fact is that there will be no return to normal. It was completely foreseeable for those who were looking at the right variables many, many years ago that this financial system was set up not necessarily to succeed, but with the seeds of its own destruction built into it that could be triggered either by accident or by intent and design, which is now unfolding, and things are going to be moving very, very fast. We're already in an accelerated phase of the meltdown, but things are going to be moving increasingly faster and faster, and the fact is we will be getting a new system, a new operating system will emerge. The question is whether that system is going to operate upon principles that value productivity, that value the overcoming of limits to growth, the way Sergei Glazyev and many other sane, competent adults in the room have been speaking about, which, you know, humanity is always a species which encounters limits based on the absence of resources, the ignorance to certain discoveries of nature that we haven't made yet. There will always be pressures on what population we can sustain, but whether or not you value as a system, whether the idea that human beings can be encouraged to make those discoveries and apply those new technologies to allow for a higher quality of life at more people, or whether you choose to create scarcity and adapt to those limits by destroying the means of creative change, which is unfortunately too much of the Kool-Aid that has been drank by the technocrats trying to manage the New World Order since 1992, especially, that will create two different worlds. And I think the Russia, China, Iran, Brazil orientation right now is much more in harmony with a society of dignity that's based upon making investments and economic behavior support the increasing productivity and the needs for those the qualitative and quantitative growths of the species in a position of harmony, finding points of cooperation instead of divide. That's much more a legitimate form of business and banking than anything we have seen, especially since John F. Kennedy was murdered 60 years ago in the West.
Well, it seems
but we will
like
get a new system, yes.
Indeed. Well, it's Gilbert Doctor, finally, it seems like the U.S., I don't want to say is blindsided, but the U.S. is definitely dealing with, as you said, a tidal wave of de-dollarization, for example. We're looking at the Brazilian president and, of course, the sentiment that he has relayed. The French president saying that, you know, de-dollarization needs to take place. India, you have the ASEAN countries who are contemplating on putting aside the dollar and euro, for that matter. How is the U.S. going to be able to respond to all these countries? I mean, one of the faults that many countries have accused the U.S. of is using the dollar as a weapon. U.S. can't go around and sanction all these countries now. What kind of reaction may we expect from the U.S.?
Global chaos. That is the U.S. foreign policy today. It didn't start yesterday. It goes back to the 1990s. But it is being put in high gear today. There are hotspots across the globe and on all continents which are being actively heated up by the United States on a conscious policy of, as I said, global chaos. And they hope to destabilize large parts of the world in a divide and conquer approach. That is their response. Very sad and very dangerous for us all.
All right, I can give you the same question. 30 seconds, Matthew Everett. Go ahead.
I unfortunately agree. The arsonists are rampant, and they're doubling down on the only thing that they know how to do, which is burn and destroy when they're not in command of the script. And the script has changed from the one that they thought they were operating on back in the 90s or even 2011. And so the chaos is the pathway being chosen right now. Whether or not the forces in the business community and diplomacy and citizen organizing have the power to overthrow that and bring about some sanity or not, I don't know yet.
Thank you for that. Matthew Everett, Senior Fellow at the American University in Moscow. Gilbert Doctorow, many thanks. Independent International Affairs Analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakhvay and the team, it's goodbye.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So, Brother Suhail, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the views and perspective of Islam regarding Jesus Christ. What is the general look of Islam at Prophet Jesus Christ or Hazrat Masih?
The views of Islam regarding Nabi Isa alayhi salam or Jesus is that he is son of Mary, born without a father, with a miracle.